You've probably heard about durable functions, but did you know that behind durable functions is the Durable Task Framework? This is an open source framework that's been out for years that helps manage long-running functions and maintain state automatically. You need to check this out. Hello, and welcome to another episode of On.net. I'm your host, Jeremy Lickness. And today, I've got Simon and Afan with me, and we're going to talk about the Durable Task Framework. Not to be confused with durable functions. This is something that I was thinking about when I first saw the title, but you'll be surprised to find there's an open source project that drives many projects actually inside and outside of Microsoft. Before we dive into that framework, though, Simon, tell me a little bit about what you do at Microsoft.
Hi, I'm Simon. I'm an engineering manager on the Azure IoT platform team, specifically for IoT Hub, where we offer a variety of platform as a service offerings. And we make heavy use of durable tasks within our systems.
Okay, and Afan?
Yes, hi, I'm Afan. I'm also an engineering manager in the IoT platform team. So as Simon mentioned, we make heavy use of the durable task framework. And so I have been involved in the original version of the Durable Task Framework, and so I've been on this since the beginning.
So you helped actually contribute to the framework.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit, let's back up for a second. What is it the framework tries to solve? What problem are we looking at here?
Sure. So the framework is meant to enable users to build workflows using code. Normally, workflows, when you think of workflows, typically you think of visual designers and boxes that you draw up and do, hey, do debit account, credit account, do something, provision a VM, create a storage account in terms of visual flows. But that did not work for us when we were building out our first provisioning system, which led us to this new approach of thinking about the problem. How can we actually use code and specifically C#? Because of all the great features in C# to build out workflows that you can just write in code and just deploy them and have them scale and be resilient and all of those things.
Well, that's interesting to hear, because I think some of the best tools are the ones that were actually created to solve a problem. Sometimes you hear about frameworks people create in search of a problem to solve, right? Yeah. So this was something that you ran into an issue and said specifically, we need a better way to do it, and that way was workflows through code.
Yeah, actually it was a hackathon project. So we were building out the provisioning system for API management, API management service that ships as an Azure service. We looked at various approaches. We looked at building a state machine-based system where you would create a storage account, and then you would store the state that, hey, I just created a storage account, and then you would go on do the next step, which is creating a VM and then tying the VM to the storage account, all of those things, right? So there was a lot of state management in the middle. So we thought, why could we not use awaits, basically the C#, .NET tasks and awaits to actually encode this very simple control flow, which becomes so complicated once you throw in databases and state machines in it. How can we encode that in code, right? So this is where it came up.
So the idea, if I understand it correctly, is instead of me explicitly opting into some sort of state management mechanism and saying, okay, I have a long-running workflow, so in code, I'm going to save my state, do all this ritual and ceremony, come back at another point, go rehydrate it, try to figure out what to do. You're taking advantage of the language features to manage state sort of behind the scenes.
Absolutely.
For the user. So for me, it's simply do something, wait for that long-running task, and continue. There's magic that happens in between, but that's taken care of by the framework.
Absolutely. So to add to that, so not only do we actually let users have awaits become durable in some sense, we also have features which in the framework which actually allow the whole process to be dehydrated to disk or service bus in this case, and then be dehydrated when there is actually work to be done. So as an example, if you have a two-step process, which is again going back to my example of create a VM and then create a storage account, right? You would create a VM, call a method which creates a VM under the covers, just makes the calls to
and that's Azure not resources. Instantaneous.
It's not spinning instantaneous. Up a yes, new exactly. VM, it takes right. like minutes, seconds, I guess, tens of seconds at least.
Sure.
If things are working out fine, but so once it creates the VM, the next step you want to do is to create a storage account. So you want to fire off the call to create a VM, and then you want the process to go to sleep, in the sense that there's no memory being used, there is no compute being used, there's no network being used.
Right.
The only time when this control flow comes back to life is when the VM was created, right? And then at that point, you want the control flow to start from the next step, which is basically create the storage account. So you do not want it to redo the whole thing again, obviously. You want to, in some sense, you want the instruction pointer to the code to be stored, persisted properly. So this we enabled using this magic of durable tasks, where the task that you get back from this framework is what we call a durable task, which is automatically stored on some storage, key value store or some service bus or some Azure storage, whichever provider you're using. And also it allows you to resume the task when the task is actually completed. So that, I guess, is the magic of durable task that we were able to use.
So you talked a little bit about Service Bus and Azure Storage. So there's some supporting mechanisms behind this that you're using to frame it in. Mm-hmm. Is there any code or example you can show to kind of drive that point home or illustrate it?
Yeah. So I think
when I came in and started working with Afan on this, at that point in time, there was a Service Bus provider which was used for the messaging flow and session state. And then Azure Tables is used for the instance store, which is really the history of the orchestration.
Okay.
And one of the things we did at that point was we made a provider model so that you could then bring your own provider.
Okay.
So Service Bus wasn't going to meet your needs, you could write a provider for SQL. There's one for storage. There is one that's going to be very soon for Redis, and another one for Service Fabric.
Okay.
So depending on the team's needs, some people, the Service Bus team, for instance, cannot take a dependency on themselves, so they have a Service Fabric provider.
Okay, interesting.
So the whole notion of the provider model was to the main design principle behind the providers was to have as little dependency on a special feature as we could. For example, all you need is a key value store and potentially a and actually that is it, literally. You give it the key value store, you should be, and some compute, obviously.
And
so
some
I was forgetting
compute.
Something. Some place to run this code as
so
well.
So I may be getting ahead of myself, but it sounds like you could potentially spin up something lightweight then for test run-throughs or smoke screens, but plug it into a production provider Service Bus active account, for example, when it's deployed. Is that
absolutely
yes.
correct?
Yes, we actually have an emulator that is an in-memory provider.
Okay.
That you can use for local testing, so you don't have any outside dependencies and or the latency or issues that come with that.
Very cool. So I see you've pulled up some code. Tell me about the code you've got.
So what I've got is I'm using the Service Bus orchestration service, which means that we're using Service Bus and storage for our state. What I've defined here is I've defined a basic I've instantiated a Service Bus client. A Service Bus orchestration service. We're going to use an Azure Table instance store for our storage connection string, and a Service Bus connection string is going to get us our queuing mechanism and state and session state. We're going to create some of the concepts are there's a client and a worker. So the client is what you will call to create a workflow and to fire it off. And then the worker is the one that's actually going to pick it. It's going to have dispatchers that'll pick up the work and run it for the orchestration, and that'll in turn spawn off activities that'll go and run. And one of the things that does is that it allows you to fan out.
Okay.
Fan out the tasks. So not only do you get the durability guarantees of long-running processes, but you can fan out across, if you have operations that are compute intensive, you can fan those out as well.
Okay.
And so the basic example I've done here is really just a sum of squares orchestration. It's just good for illustrating the a few of the concepts, but it obviously is not something you're going to be using in production.
And the orchestration, you can think of that as a control flow for the workflow, and activities as the actual leave actual work items that the control flow
is driving. So my flow chart, all my arrows and decisions are part of the orchestration, and my nodes are going to be activities.
Exactly.
Okay,
Got it. And every orchestration has a state, and that state is what it uses to replay into the previous activities results. So what I've got is I've created an array. It's an array of either numbers or array of or subarrays of numbers.
Okay.
And this orchestration is just going to go and it's going to sum the squares of all the numbers.
Okay.
So I'll get back to this code in a second, but I want to show you the activity that we've defined is pretty simple. All it's going to do is it's going to receive a number. It's going to return the square of that.
Okay.
We have an orchestration which we've defined. It's going to take the input, and it's going to parse it as JSON, and then it is going to loop through the items in that JSON. And if it's an array, it's going to create what's called a sub-orchestration. Now, a sub-orchestration is an orchestration within an orchestration, but it has its own lifetime, essentially.
Right, but they're tied to each other.
Yes.
So the parent's never going to end until the child ends.
So think of this as a workflow spinning up another workflow, in some sense.
And so this is a recursive... Yes. Sub-orchestration, basically.
Yes. So if we've said if it's an array, we're going to create a sub-orchestration, which is going to go do its thing. If it's an integer, it's just going to go and call that activity that I just showed you that does the multiplier.
Okay.
And then it's going to, each of these is going to be creating a task, and then we just do a when all on our tasks, and then we're going to sum the results of that, and then that's going to be the result of our orchestration. So a little bit more about how we've got this set up is we have the client, which we're going to call to instantiate it, and we're going to have the worker, which is actually going to do the work. And on the worker, we're registering our orchestration, where you register the type itself. And then the activity, we've only done just one, because it's a simple example, but the sum of squares task. So we're basically registering our code with the worker so that it knows what to do.
And the worker is the unit of scale as well. So imagine this one worker is running on a single VM, right? So it is processing n number of orchestrations as the client says, hey, run this workflow. This worker is the only one picking up all of these and actually executing them. You could throw in more workers as well. Give them the same connection string as you see as this one is being given. They all will compete for work on the same service bus store in this case.
Does this project also handle, so this handles the orchestration and the clients and the flows. Does it handle providing the infrastructure, the scale out, or does something else have to provide the different VMs or processes?
That we've left as an exercise for the deployer because there were so many different combinations of places where you can offer.
Right.
So we have samples that show you how to run it in a single process, but actually running it in a different hosting environment is not a part of the sample.
Okay.
But
so when we talk about, because I know a lot of people get confused a little bit, they hear durable task framework, they think durable functions. Durable functions uses this, but part of the services it's providing is managing that scale out and providing hosts, basically, for all the processes.
That's advantage, definitely. The durable functions is a more managed way of using durable task framework.
Got it. Yeah. Okay,
and
makes
they've
sense.
Also got the rich integration with the dev experience to host your functions and everything like that as well.
Right.
So they're ready to bring all those things together.
Okay.
Once we've got our orchestrations and our activities registered, we'll start it, and then here we can use the client. We can create an orchestration. We'll tell it what type it is, and we'll give it the input, which is that bag of numbers JSON that I showed earlier. And then we're going to do a simple wait for orchestration. I've got a little bit of debug that shows in here that what's going to do, but what's not apparent here is what's going to happen is it's actually going to be doing a whole bunch of messaging. We could have had this running on 5 or 10 machines. I was just saying is you could have the client on one machine. You could have 5 machines doing the orchestration hosts, and you could have 15 or 20 machines running activities depending on what they're doing. So if we take this now and we run it, it is going to start up, and we'll see that we've got our basic input.
Now it's passing.
So the original orchestration got that in. It then went and said, I'm going to run activities for the 2, the 3, and sub-orchestrations for the 4 and the 5. So that's actually gone and sent that back out to be more work.
Right.
And then we'll get more orchestration input for that. We'll get more orchestration input for the others that we've defined in here. and those will fan out, and then they're eventually going to fan back in as we run all the squares. And at the end, where we've got our debug down here, the sum of the squares is all the orchestrations actually completing, and so you can see that the inner ones are fanning back in until eventually we get the sum of squares, which is the 2869, which is the sum of all those squares.
So in some sort, this is basically doing a scatter gather. So if you have a farm of machines, it is the main orchestration is going to take the input, break it into chunks, and then create either sub orchestrations out of it if there are bigger sequences, or it's just going to random them off to activities which are leaf level nodes. So leaf nodes, right, versus sub workflows, and it's going to wrap up all the results after fanning them out, collect all the results, and then paste them on the screen. Interestingly, this is also reliable. So if in the middle of the workflow, if the machine just blew up, right, and it just went down, restarted, it would start from the exact same spot where it actually crashed. So because the state is saved, it actually remembered the last await it was stuck on, waiting for, and then it will just resume from that.
So that's actually one of your constraints inside the main orchestration, is that it has to be reliable code, right? Yes. I can't generate a random number and make decisions based on randomness, because then your flow is not working. Yes. But as long as it's I don't even want to jump into words like idempotent and whatever. But as long as it's a consistent flow, but the activities that it calls, those nodes, those can do pretty much whatever they want to do.
Absolutely. Exactly. As you said, the control flow is a special place. That is where the programmer, actually, that's the trade-off that we made. That whatever you write within that special orchestration code needs to be deterministic. So you cannot have random numbers. You cannot have get me the current temperature or something like that.
Right.
You cannot do something that will yield a different result the next time it is replayed.
But that's in the control flow.
Yes, that's the control flow. Activities are a fair game.
Yeah, but we do have some specific functionality that enables things that you need. So you can create it. We have timers and things like that. So if you're going to create an orchestration that's going to fire off an activity that's waiting for someone to manually approve something, and that could take 3 days, and you say, I'm going to wait up to 3 days, and if they don't finish, then you can actually code that into your orchestration to have timers fire, because you can't do a regular timer, you can't do
right.
a few things
so,
like
so
that.
This is actually, what we've brought up is several advantages so far. So the way that this manages state means that I have a resilient process, so if something were to fail in the middle of it, it's preserving state so it can replay up to that point and then continue running. So if we crash, we restart, we still get the output that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is scalability, so you can have multiple workers dealing with the work that's handed off from the orchestrator. And then it sounds like there's a lot of patterns that are sort of built into the framework. So we talked about fan out and fan in. I'm waiting for multiple processes, and then I want to converge them back to a result. I'm assuming you have like asynchronous sequential workflows, so wait for one, then the next.
Yeah. And then the nice thing is that this is all built using .NET tasks, familiar concepts, right?
Right.
If you want to do a sequential workflow, you'll await task one, and then you'll await task two, and then await task three.
Well, I want to call that out, because in your code...
Yeah, so we did a task when all over here.
Right.
But we could have done an await on this, and then an await on the next one.
Sure.
And then an await on the next one, if we wanted to do them one at a time.
Yeah. But this when all is deceptive, because it looks like just a simple line of code, but what you're really doing is all this orchestration and state management and basically storing history in the background, right?
Yes. Yeah, so basically, exactly. This simple orchestration actually created N tasks. Right, and every task represented some work that was executing on a different machine potentially.
Right.
And the task would only complete when the machine had executed that piece of code and returned some value or some result, and that result will be passed back to the awaiter or the entity that is actually getting the result from that task. So and then this task that you get back from the framework in this special context can be manipulated just like any other .NET task. You can await it, you can chain it with other tasks, you can use continue with as well, you can actually do a task.whenAll, task.whenAny, any of the patterns that you are familiar with in .NET task, you can apply in this, in
so,
this context.
So it sounds like if I want to level up my C# knowledge and get behind the scenes of what await and async does, this open source project would be a,
absolutely, a
place to start digging and see how you hook into those language features.
We have done some pretty interesting gymnastics in how we built this out. It's an interesting read for someone who wants to just experience the some idiosyncrasies of
I'm going to give it the 15-minute rule. I'll look at the code for 15 minutes, and if it's still completely foreign to me, I'll say it's a good thing they wrote it and not me. Now, the example that you're showing to get started with this entire framework, is that do you have to pull down the code, compile it? Is it as easy as a NuGet package reference? How do you start plugging into the durable task
so
framework?
So we have some NuGet packages.
Okay.
If you want to dig into the code, you can as well. But the GitHub repo that we have does have some samples that allow you to get started with some documentation.
And I assume the packages give you kind of fine-grained control over what features of the framework you want to use?
Yeah, so we have a core. There's a core package, which is the core runtime of this whole thing. But then there's the emulator, which you'd bring in for your testing purposes and just general tooling around. And then you'd pick what your providers is and bring in whatever packages are for your relevant provider.
Okay, that sounds good. We'll put all those links in the show notes so people can go out and grab that. Now, one of the things are, did you still have something you wanted to show with this demo? Because I have a question that
I don't want to distract.
So we've been talking about the durable functions because that's something I think a lot of people are familiar with. But my understanding is there are a lot of internal projects, even at Microsoft, that depend on the durable task framework. Are you familiar with others of this? You mentioned IoT Hub as well, using that for provisioning.
Yeah, so the first project that we started with was API. So in the context of provisioning, so we have used this framework a lot in just the control plane for our services. For example, API management, when you go and create a new API management service, the durable task framework runs in the background and creates all the necessary resources and ties them together into one unit and then presents it to the user. IoT Hub similarly uses this to build out the control plane. So whenever you go and create an IoT Hub, it actually uses this framework to go and create X and Y and Z resource and then string them together. Besides that, this is also used in the runtime plane as well for IoT Hub. If you go to IoT Hub and use this feature we call device jobs, which is basically if you have a million devices connected to your IoT Hub and you want to run a command or you want to update the what we call a device state, device twin, for the million devices, you just make one call to the IoT Hub and IoT Hub will give you back an operation status or operation cookie, which you can use to track status.
And it's using one of these orchestrations.
Basically under the cover. It is a big, massive orchestration with a lot of sub orchestrations, which divvy up into device orchestrations, right? So use it to manage state for that. There were other, I think.
There's a couple of other teams. We've actually been surprised. I had someone new join the team about 8 months ago, and he said, "Hey, you know, I found your name on Durable Task. We've like got 5 different teams using it within his old team." So there's a couple of users out there that we don't know of, but there's a number of teams that are using us,
and
which is great.
It has all been organic, so we've never I think this is the first time we're ever on a on a show about this thing. It has been organic just because it was just useful. It was occupying a.
Can you think of other situations? We talked about provisioning and workflows in general, but are there some canonical, like if you're in manufacturing and you have this problem, or can you think of other patterns, if you will, that lend themselves to this framework? So if someone's watching this, they say, oh, I've been struggling with this over here, maybe I should look into the durable task framework.
Abstractly speaking, if you have a long running process, by definition, that needs to be stateful, otherwise it is not efficient, because if it's long running, either you keep everything in memory, and then you wait until the whole thing is done.
Right.
Or you can make it stateful. In the first case, by the way, it's also not reliable. If it's in memory, the machine can crash and you can lose your state. So it's a long-running process. It is probably stateful, which means that you checkpoint at every point in that step. Then you need something like dribble tasks to make it easy for you to write code for that.
Right.
Which actually brings in a lot of scenarios you just mentioned. Potentially, manufacturing might be an interesting one. Mostly we have seen LOB integrations, like business processes. Workflow scenarios, like SharePoint has this document workflow scenario. We have a document that needs to be approved by five different people. Somebody writes up a document, it goes to person number one, they approve it, goes to person number two, they approve it. Maybe an expense report kind of thing, right? Where okay. the gaps are dependent on a human actually looking up an alert and saying, okay, I need to go to this portal.
So right, because you can wait for that manual process using the workflow.
Exactly.
And it could be literally days or weeks or months.
Right.
And this can just sit there dehydrated
That's something I've done with durable functions, but not with the durable task framework. Mm. This gives me a whole new set of things to play with. Are you still involved, on either of you, on the core team adding features or supporting?
So me, not as much as Simon and the folks on his team are actively doing bug fixes.
Any major exciting features? Is it more stabilization and cleaning up defects that are found in the field? Or
there's some optimizations and things like that right now, because it's a replay based. It means that it's going to dehydrate and rehydrate and potentially. That means it does it's a little more chatty to itself from a compute standpoint. So Durable Functions has already implemented a sticky concept where it will stack things and optimize the replay. But the core framework doesn't implement that yet.
Okay, so that's something that could be brought in. Because I know that you have some concessions that if I'm intentional about it, for example, if I'm running an infinite loop, that's obviously not going to make sense because the history builds and builds, but I can kind of kick off the task as if it's new, but still maintain the state from the previous. So there are those hooks already in place.
Yes. So it's exactly. Another thing that we have been thinking about is just adding inline execution of activities as well. For simpler activities, just having a lambda, for example, just inline.
Okay, so you're not having that. To create it as
a you don't have to go and create a new activity and go through all the machinery. So we're thinking about some optimizations. Again, to Simon's point, it's more about optimizing the flow as we continue to consume it within our data plane as well. For example, IT Hub uses Durable Task. We continue to find opportunities to optimize the flow as well. So, but it's all based on feedback that we're getting and generally the pain points, the top pain points that are on our list.
Awesome. Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for coming out and sharing the demo and your knowledge about the Durable Task Framework. I'm going to say that this is a framework that is used heavily internally and externally. It's open source. And it's baked into some of our most important services. So if you're doing anything with any of these patterns we've discussed, if you're working on long-running workflows, you definitely need to check out the Durable Task Framework.